Go.
What is going on, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome back to the White Belt Podcast. My name is Fernandez, and every single episode, it's my goal for you to level up in some way your movement and your mindset so that you can go and live your fittest and most fulfilled life. And today, I'm super excited to introduce my guest, who is a movement idol of mine, certainly one of the people that introduced me to the idea of movement in general, and his name is John Yuen. Now, John Yuen is a movement practitioner and movement teacher from Norway. And words don't do any justice to the way this man moves, so I really encourage you to go to his Instagram at yuenjon, that's Y-U-E-N-J-O-N, on Instagram and check out some of this guy's stuff because it's insane. Now, not only is he an incredibly accomplished practitioner, but he's also a truly excellent teacher. And I think it's his kind of depth and breadth of experience in the physical practices, like in his long experience as a martial arts practitioner. He's worked as a professional dancer in the Norwegian opera. He's done different forms of strength and conditioning for over 20 years. And it's all of these different experiences that I think give him these unique perspectives and ways of expressing concepts around movement and the body and building strength and mobility and fluidity that are super unique and you're not really gonna hear anywhere else. So without any further ado, I'm just gonna let this man speak. I really hope you enjoyed this one because this was a really massive moment for me. I've wanted to interview this guy since even before I started podcasting. So I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. Please welcome John Yuen. Oh, yeah, man, I'm really excited to do this. So thanks for being here first and foremost, man.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I would love to start by kind of jumping back a little bit to, I remember there was this excerpt of a post I read of yours where you were talking about sitting on the front porch of your parents' house, listening to cassettes of their favorite Motown records, pressing play and then pressing rewind and then pressing play and kind of trying to figure out your own dance moves to these songs. And
yeah,
I want to start there because I want to try and get an insight on how your movement journey started, how everything that you do, where that started. And I'd love to kind of follow that thread and see where we go.
Thanks for that blast from the past. I guess it started there, you know. Mm-hmm. I was not very interested in sports, you know, when I grew up. I didn't find it interesting. But I did like grooving along with some tunes, and it felt very personal and it felt very fun at the same time. So like from an early age, I was always interested in music. And then that kind of disappeared for some time after I started training martial arts. My dad encouraged me and my brother to train a bit. He trained us. I actually found an old hard drive with a bunch of footage of me and my brother being taught like different forms by my father.
What age was this around?
I think I must have been like 4 or 5.
Oh wow! Okay.
We were wearing those old school silk pajamas, like kung fu pajamas with the dragons and shit on them. And we
definitely had me a pair of those.
Oh yeah. We looked hella cute. But no, it wasn't like until maybe the age of 12, 13, where I started practicing martial arts a bit more in a somewhat more focused manner.
Mm-hmm.
And then I trained that for a couple of years, started doing some strength and conditioning training when I was about 15, joined the gym. And then like I mentioned, we were into music, and that was mostly due to my mother's encouragement. She encouraged all of us to play any kind of instrument, really. And I ended up singing in the choir, which led to me working in the opera in Norway. And then after a show, I was approached by this old school ballet teacher from the States, who was living in Norway, and he basically said, like, you should dance. Like, I guess he saw something, and he he took me under his wing and he started teaching me privately. And an amazing person. He believed in me and dedicated so much of his time and energy to kind of teach me and encourage me further. And that encouragement led to me wanting to pursue a career in dance, which I did for a couple of years.
Wow.
And then, while I was dancing, I was always doing some sort of strength and conditioning training. Mm-hmm. And got to a point in my career where I was not comfortable being on stage anymore. I didn't want to be on stage. And I really honestly couldn't, due to a lot of stage fright, which led to just like general anxiety. And that's when I decided to look into strength and conditioning as a potential career. And then I did that.
Yeah, and that's so fascinating.
Now I'm here.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd be really interested, if you're open to talking about it, what led to you not being comfortable on stage anymore? Was there a particular thing that happened? And it's okay if you don't want to go there.
Oh, sure thing. No. I'm totally open about it. And I think it's a chicken and the egg type of situation. I don't know if I had stage fright first or if I had anxiety first, but regardless of which of the two came first, it just got to the point where it was impossible for me to be on stage.
Hmm.
I wasn't comfortable in my everyday life, nor on stage, and getting off the stage seemed to be like one of the deciding factors that would allow me to kind of continue without without dreading each waking hour, you know? So I quit. And it didn't feel like an escape. Like it didn't feel like I had to run away from being on stage. I quit slowly and gradually. And I allowed myself as much of a smooth transition as I could into a new life. As for what the reason for the anxiety was, I don't know. I think there's a bit of genetic disposition there. There are other people in my family who've had to deal with similar things. There's definitely, a personality component of me being worried about other people's opinion of me. And just not being able to balance at that point in my life ambition and contentment, how can I be ambitious and still be okay with who I am? At that point, I think I was more focused on the ambition. So I sacrificed a lot of time and energy and thoughts into becoming the next version of myself, and instead of kind of being okay, being friendly with the current version of me.
Yeah, that is not an easy knife edge to walk, for sure. And we were actually just talking before we hit record about how it's healthy to have a certain level of inner critic and to look at yourself and look at what you can improve on after, say, a workshop that you just taught. We're talking about, it's important to look at your own performance and or one's own performance and say, okay, cool, here's what I did well, but also what can I do better, and to constantly be striving, I guess, to improve yourself in some way. And that can be a really rewarding process, or it can be a vice grip that is very difficult to get out of. And I've definitely been in my own flavor of that myself, and always looking to the next thing. And it starts to suck a lot of the joy and even the effectiveness out of the stuff that I was doing at that time. So it's really interesting to hear that you had the same experience with dance. Was that a difficult transition for you to make, to give up, or did that feel like you were going in the right direction when you were starting to move out of performing?
I mean, thinking back on it, I'm not sure if it even felt like I had a choice, because it was, it was so difficult to do the job. The transition was difficult. It was like losing a person in your life. It was an emotional and a mental amputation of a huge part of me, like the part of me that I had invested the most time and energy in, and blood, sweat, and tears and all that jazz. So, yeah, you know, after quitting, I didn't have a label attached to me, which I know now was meant to be liberating, but at the time it felt scary as hell, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it was difficult, but it was also necessary, and it was something that I'm very happy that happened.
Yeah. I resonate with that so much. And sometimes those really scary kind of cliff jumps, without having any idea what's on the other side of that, can be, with hindsight, it's easy to look back and say, oh, that was awesome, and there was so much meaning around that. But what can get swept under the rug sometimes is just how fucking scary and terrifying that can be at the time, when you don't know, you don't have the confirmation of that happily ever after story that's you know, on the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially, you know, when you're younger, you know, you don't necessarily trust the future version of yourself a whole lot. At least I didn't then.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd love to jump back to the period where you started training martial arts. That was in China, correct?
Yeah. I mean, I started training martial arts here in Norway.
Okay.
But most of my training, like the hardest part of my training, and I guess the most entertaining and exciting part of my training, was in China. So that was when I was about 15, 16.
Mm-hmm.
When I moved there with my brother too, we wanted to, well, both we and our Chinese father wanted us to connect with that particular part of our roots. So he offered us to live in China for a year with a minimum amount of money and to just learn Chinese and train.
Yeah. Wow. Did you pause your schooling for this experience as well? Or?
I did.
Wow.
For a year.
Talk to me about what this was like. What martial arts were you training? What did your day-to-day look like? What was the content of the training? I'd love to hear more about this.
Sure. So, like the biggest part of my day-to-day life was trying to learn Mandarin, which happened in the AM. And after that, we would travel downtown to this old Chinese opera house. So it was a beautiful gym, this huge hall with red, big wooden pillars. And it was just one big room. So we didn't have any walls to separate any of the classes, which I loved, because, you know, in one corner they were doing hatha yoga, and the other side of the room they were doing kickboxing, and then you had praying mantis. Everything happening all at once, which is how I like to kind of look at activities.
Yeah.
Try not to get too focused or get too distracted by the walls that are between them. And I guess that's where, like, my initial interest for kind of understanding dogmas and cultural baggage and the culture behind movement started. But I was mostly doing wushu while I was there, but I also did sanda, so Chinese kickboxing. I did yoga. I did Wing Chun. I did like praying mantis style. And I think those were the classes I took at that time. So yeah, we had a bunch of wonderful teachers who were very strict, who didn't hold anything back, who put me in my place a number of times. And yeah, a lot of hard and good training.
Mm. What lessons, like, what could, you know, if you were going to put, let's say, the kind of regular gym crowd, in inverted commas, into a bucket and say, what could they learn from the way that martial artists train, or that more traditional Chinese martial arts school of thought? Like, what lessons could you or did you extract from that that maybe a more conventional weight training population could really benefit from?
Well, I guess the first thing that comes to mind is to make sure you have more than one reason for doing a thing. Mm. You know, like reasons come and go. You can train martial arts because you initially wanted to beat up the neighborhood bully, or because you wanted to learn how to defend yourself, or because you wanted to look cool. But like, one of the good things about conventional or classic martial arts is that they teach you, you know, all the stereotypical lessons, you know, of being peaceful and being confident and being mindful, being present, being disciplined, being curious, respecting the history, trying to understand it a bit better. And I think the same thing should apply to, like, you know, the stuff that's happening in the conventional gym. Mm-hmm. Have more reasons, you know, there's more to training than looking good or being strong or looking cool. It can be, you know, a practice that can allow you to investigate certain parts about yourself. It can just be a grounding habit, something that you do to kind of get in touch with your body. It's totally possible to get in touch with your body doing a bicep curl, you know, so have more reasons. That way you have more to fall back on if you start to, you know, become demotivated because you don't feel like you're able to get to that body or that level of strength or that level of skill as quickly as you thought you would.
I love that. That's awesome. And what about if we were to flip the script a little bit, looking back with your knowledge of strength and conditioning now, and looking at the way that those martial arts schools taught, however much they might have balanced to the skill component, to the strength component, or the flexibility component, or any of that, like, what would you go back and, if you could train young John then in martial arts, like, how would you change the training? It could be anything from the programming to the mindset stuff. I'd love to hear about it.
A lot of things. I mean, classical martial arts have a way of eliminating those who don't have the time, the energy, or the genetic disposition to perform the martial art. And they often do that by way of pain, right? So it's about doing some sort of training that is as uncomfortable as possible. And, you know, that's not necessarily the quickest way to progress. You learn how to push yourself more. You learn how to put in more intensity, but that is not necessarily a pure reflection of the physiological adaptation that happens when you work out. A lot of people experience progression simply by way of pushing themselves further and further and further when it comes to the immediate effort. So one thing that I would do is to go like, okay, we don't have to hurt ourselves. It's a great way to, you know, increase your pain tolerance and to increase your tolerance in general and discipline. But it is, discipline deserves a lifetime. There's no reason why we should pile on so much pain and discomfort simply to see whether or not we're going to be able to keep doing this for like a month or half a year or a year.
Yeah. You
know? And I mean, I want as many activities as possible to be as open to as many people as possible. So if that means that, I'd be totally okay with lowering the general standard of an activity in terms of how painful, how difficult, or even how skilled for the practitioners are, if it allows more people to do it.
I think this is a really important thread to follow, in a sense, because I've seen this quite a lot. I've had a fascination with martial arts training more from a distance, to be honest. I have only, I did like a little bit of Kung Fu as a kid in a very not especially traditional school. And it was very much like a kindergarten that taught martial arts. You know what I mean? It was more just kind of, it wasn't very serious. And I did a little bit of Muay Thai as well. But I've been fascinated with kind of going down those YouTube rabbit holes of seeing how they train in the Shaolin Temple. And there's so much wisdom to be learned from there. But I think one of the things that jumps out to me as a coach as well is like the flexibility training, for example. The super intensive partner stretching that often they will see people get the splits in very, very short amount of times, for example. But the question I always wonder is, well, how many people did they hurt in the process of that? Because my felt experience, at least, is there's only so hard that you can push things before things sometimes break. So yeah, with your experience about like the flexibility training, like you know, super heavy weighted partner stretching, like is that a good way for someone to think about achieving, let's say, a split? Or is that what you credit your flexibility training to? How do you think about that?
I mean, when it comes to most exercise interventions or methods, you know, the questions that we often need to ask ourselves are, can you keep up and are you progressing? And that, I think, counts for everything. You know, we get very focused on the fine details and the techniques and the methods, but bottom line is there a positive trend and can the trend continue? And when it comes to a lot of the partner stretches they do like in wushu type of kung fu and many other martial arts, like for some there will be a positive trend and for some they can continue the trend, but that would be, I think, the exception, the minority of people. And, you know, a lot of these methods are given to people who are fairly young as well, you know, they're beginners and they're younger and their bodies might be able to tolerate a bit more. They're a bit more plastic and it can, I think for some of them, like it might work, but in general, like, yeah, it's probably too hard. Probably won't be able to continue.
Yeah. That's a really interesting insight. I've noticed a similar thing when I've been kind of teasing out lessons from gymnastics, for example. Often the way that they, there's been a big trend starting with kind of Coach Christopher Summer, who did amazing stuff for the whole, I guess, movement industry in general. You know, taking lessons from elite gymnasts and you know, how do they train and what are the progressions even to get to where they are and how can we apply them to us as well? But it's a similar concept as well. A lot of those gymnasts start with particular methods that are from a very, very young age. You can't necessarily copy and paste that onto an adult coming off the couch or an adult who's doing, you know, single plane weighted exercises for their whole life and then all of a sudden expect to have exactly the same result. It's quite different. So I'm glad you brought this up.
Yeah, you know, it's one of the most appealing or attractive ideas is that we can bring out the ideas and methods from environments or cultures that are very foreign to ours. But the problem is that you're bringing an idea from a culture and an environment that is very foreign to you, which means that you haven't done it before. It might involve a totally different population. You know, the elite gymnastic coach, they tend to work with a very different population from us mere mortals.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't mean that we can't learn anything from them, but it's probably best not to try to replicate them.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Cool. So, there's so many places I want to go, but I want to talk to you more about your dance training as well. And so you've been singing in this choir and then a ballet teacher approaches you, correct me if I'm wrong, and says, you should come and dance with me. Like, what do you think he saw in you at that stage?
I have no idea. I really don't know. He'd seen me in one show. It was an opera called Andreasen, in which I was, in that I didn't really have a role. I was just an extra. And I had one scene where I was doing like a shitty pas de deux, like a dance between two people on stage.
Right.
Like, and at that point, I didn't feel like I was given a choreography. They just said, oh, then you do this, and then you do this, and then she does this, and then you do this. And I was like, okay, yeah, I can remember that. But yeah, he'd seen it. And I guess, I don't know what he saw, but I'm glad he got in touch.
Yeah, must have been something.
Yeah.
So what did your, you know, I've never had an experience in ballet, but I'd love for you to talk a little bit about, like, what was that training like for you? What was that learning environment like to you? And what kind of lessons have you brought forward into the present that you kind of still take with you and maybe even apply to your own practice today?
My training was fairly unique because it was just this teacher and me, you know, in a studio. And I'm so happy that I got that experience because I wasn't wearing a leotard. I wasn't wearing like a skinny onesie or anything like that. I was just there in my sweatpants and a baggy Led Zeppelin t-shirt. And I was there with this guy who just like, he didn't impose any ideas of like the dance culture on me. Mm. He was just like, okay, so here's a technique. Here's why we use this technique. Here's what it's good for. Here's like how we use it in our training. The reason we might fall back on this technique. But like we didn't really do any dancing. It was more like just like, here's the bar. Here are a bunch of these techniques. Here's me. Like we didn't have any music. He would just snap his fingers and he would count, and then I would do different things.
Wow.
So it felt like this very, I'm not going to say pure environment, because you know, we're people. We're always influencing our environment. But yeah, it felt like this very open way of approaching ballet. And it was great. Like I never entertained the idea of ever doing ballet, and I didn't really like ballet, you know, as a dance style myself. Mm. Because it didn't feel right for my body, because I've always been a fairly big guy in terms of weight distributed by height.
Yeah.
I'm not a tall guy, but yeah, it didn't feel right for my body, but I loved it. I loved learning about it. And I loved, you know, interacting with this guy and kind of picking his brain and allowing him to kind of just experiment with different training methods and ways of encouraging a student.
I'm really starting to see how your unique training experience growing up has really informed, I guess, the way that you do. Because one, I found you on Instagram maybe 5-6 years ago, and I was like, how do you train to do this? That was always one of the questions in my mind about how you can kind of cultivate this combination of obvious like physical prowess and strength, flexibility, and like the raw materials from a physiological level of there, but also the control and the skill and the grace and the improvisation. That seems to be so many different qualities that, and this is kind of the thread that I'd like to follow a little bit more, is that there are, you know, I think if anyone listening has had a movement practice or has started to dive into that, there are so many things. There are infinite ways of moving. There are infinite skills from different disciplines to master. And to, once you scratch the surface, you find out that there's 30,000 other things that you couldn't even master in a lifetime.
Mm.
And sometimes coming to a practice like that, it can be easy. I know in my experience, I came out of the gate and tried to do a lot of the strength stuff, but then a lot of the maybe a bit of flexibility stuff, and then maybe a little bit of skill stuff, and just never really did enough of anything to progress very fast. So I'd love for you to talk into a little bit, and this might not be your experience, but at least how you train clients.
Hmm.
If someone came to you wanting to develop flexibility, skills like handstands, some strength qualities, you know, some floor work and some of the stuff that you did.
Hmm.
How would you approach a conversation with that person, and what kind of expectations would you set? And maybe even what would that process look like?
Well, I think one of my primary goals when first talking to a client is to figure out what the actual challenge is. Sometimes it's a matter of them not being able to notice their own increase of competence. And so, you know, they're not able to measure or notice that they're improving, and so they stop. Sometimes it's a matter of not being able to kind of create a practice. You know, they have a lot of things they want to do, and they get hyper focused on one thing at a time, and they progress in that one thing, but they're not happy with the lack of progression in the things that they do not do. So kind of being able to get an overview over how they kind of schedule their days and how they inform their bodies with movement throughout the day is pretty important. Sometimes it's that they don't allow themselves to be creative. They don't allow themselves to create their own type of training, an individual type of training. And because, you know, a lot of times people assume that the best way for a person to progress is by doing what's scientifically proven to be the most optimal way of progressing as quickly as possible in all these different ways. But like, I don't think that our psyche deep down cares about what's most optimal. I think it cares about what's most meaningful to the individual. So you need kind of just have a conversation and talk it out, you know, like, what's on your mind? What do you believe is the challenge for you in this particular type of situation? And how can we allow ourselves to put ourselves in a creative mindset where we use our, you know, our knowledge as much as our imagination to come up with a proper solution? And I like to keep things pretty simple and pretty basic. You know, I don't think everything deserves to be complex in order to be effective. So sometimes it's just a matter of changing our mindset. Sometimes it's a matter of saying to ourselves that, okay, I'm willing to jump off the deep end and do something that's scary. You know, a lot of people who, for example, want to move with a bit more freedom or move a bit more flowy or like move in a more artistic or creative way, the thing that's stopping them is fear. It's not a lack of ability. That's rarely the case. Or I would say it's generally never the case. But yeah, it's not like I do something for my clients. We have a conversation and we work things out together.
Yeah, I'd love, this is really cool because this, I'm just remembering, like if I heard this, what you were saying, maybe like 4 or 5 years ago, I would have been like, what? But what's the optimal? Where's the magic program somewhere out there that exists that is meant to give me those optimal goals or gains? I remember, you know, as a slightly younger man thinking that if I just found the optimal mix of everything, the one true program to rule them all, then I would have the best gains in the world and be able to do everything with my body. And that's, you know, simply not the case. And that might sound obvious or even a bit cliche, but I think it's important to really recognize, because this process of inquiry, this process of finding out what someone would love to be able to do with their body, what maybe the challenges are they face with their unique body and their exercise history, with their time, with their own perception of how capable they are. All of these things go into creating a particular program for a unique human being that can't really be. A lot of stuff gets lost if it's just going to be a program for, let's say, the press to handstand, and you're just going to be like, here is a program for the press to handstand. It's not as linear as it's sometimes given off in when you're going down the road of YouTube tutorials and online programs, and you know, it's easy to kind of fall into this trap. So I think it's really important to highlight you can have this little bit more DIY approach when it comes to training. This is something you talk a lot about.
Oh yeah, I think it's incredibly important. And like what you mentioned, like the one program to rule them all. There's a reason why the One Ring is really, really fucking heavy to carry.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
What is optimal has the least flexibility. You know, if the idea of what's optimal tends to have the least flexibility, and we need that flexibility, not just to adapt to an individual, but also in order for us to actually be flexible in our training, because it's very rare that you're going to be able to perform or do your program without making tweaks and changes here and there to readjust your course, you know?
Yeah, 100%. This is something that I see come up a lot, especially in the conventional gym setting or even like a powerlifting context, which is slightly different because I guess they only have a limited number of goals. So you can become a little bit more mathematical with it. Mm-hmm. But even the idea of calculating an entire 12-week block off a sometimes estimated 1 RM percent, you know, 1 RM, and then taking percentages of this. This is sometimes what powerlifters do when they say, okay, I'm going to hit, you know, 80% of my 1 RM for 6 on this day, and then 85% on this day. And it's all mathematically and titrated out and to this peak. Mm. And often what I find with those things is that sometimes there's definite value in that approach. It's definite value. Mm-hmm. And it's, especially when you have less variables, you can kind of get away with it sometimes.
Yeah.
But I think that some of those approaches that get a little bit too mathematical from the programming aside don't take into account enough other variables, like how might you have slept the night before, and are you really ready to perform this lift at this intensity on this day? Or would that have been better saved for the 2 days beforehand when you were feeling excellence and you'd slept really well and you didn't have that crazy meeting at work coming up?
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's somewhere in between. I'd love you to talk into this a little bit. How to find the mix of what is enough structure so that you have measurement and you have knowledge that you're progressing, but not so much rigidity that you kind of lose out and you're like, oh, well, I now, every rep is accounted for the next 12 weeks and it has no flexibility.
Well, I think the first thing that needs to be said is that even the best program is still just guessing.
Yes.
I know it's we trainers make things very difficult for a lot of people because of how we often need to convince ourselves with as much certainty as possible that we know our shit. And in order to do that, we have to kind of promote our programming and our training by kind of being able to implying that we know how to predict the future, which we don't. There are too many variables in a program, and there's also too many variables in our population for us to say with that degree of certainty that we know what's going to happen. You're still guessing. And if you say that you're not, then, well, ignorance is a bliss.
Or lying is good marketing.
Yeah. That's true. The second thing I would say is that you mentioned, you know, the DIY mindset. I think that is incredibly important. I think that we need to involve our clients in the program design process, make them understand that we're not sitting, it shouldn't be this top-down approach where we act as if we're sitting with the answers to all of their questions, and that these answers are the foundation of a good program. What I like to do with my clients is sit down with them and we write the program together so that they understand that their input and their ideas are valuable in the program design process. And to understand like that this is a creative endeavor as much as a scientific one. It's not just about finding answers. It's also about entertaining ideas. And a good program, a good holistic program, is the ability to entertain more than one idea at a time. And you can't entertain more ideas at a time if you are 100% reliant on so-called correct answers.
Mm.
Now, when it comes to structuring this more quantitative approach and a more like creative, free-form, auto-regulating approach, I think what we need to accept is that structure is, you know, a human-made construct, or at least the structure of a program, and we get to decide what it is. And so like, for example, there are programs where the structure is in one part of the program, you are going to do your bicep isolation exercise of choice. You decide on the day what you want to do. That is your structure. Because we've found that it's difficult for the individual in question to stick to an exercise for a fairly long amount of time, or that they are very attracted to new exercises. They like playing with new stuff. So instead of then creating a structure that makes it difficult for them to play with or explore new exercises, why don't we put it in the program? Is it optimal? No, but we can at least allow it to be part of the plan.
Mm.
And for that individual, that creating that sort of plan might turn out to be optimal in the long run. But of course, like getting to this type of mindset is difficult. It does take time. You need to kind of explore the limits of what you're comfortable structuring. You need to understand that your expectations aren't necessarily optimal.
Mm.
You know, so for some clients, I'm not gonna sit here and tell them, no, you need to understand when you have worked as a trainer for about 15 years, you'll quickly understand that your idea is not actually doable. Like, I can't sit here and kind of deprive people from experiences. So sometimes I design that experience that they want and let them try it out. And then they can see whether or not that works for them.
Mm.
And if they notice that, okay, that's not the kind of experience that I was expecting, or I would actually like something else, then cool, that is a part of the plan. This part of the program, this little experience, that was, we're going to allow ourselves to let that be a part of the plan.
I think this is really cool. And this certainly, you know, in my mind, this is a big take home for, you know, people listening back at home, because for a long time, I, like I said, thought that I would just, like, there was a right way to program and a wrong way to program. And every time I found a conflicting idea in the space, which was never, of course, you know, which was all the time, I'd be like, oh, but man, but this expert guy said this and this other person said this. And what you're saying is really allowing a lot of freedom for people to create experiments, to enjoy the process of being curious, and to decide for themselves what is working and what is not working, and to decide what they enjoy and what they don't enjoy, and to make that process part of it, as opposed to the inconvenient truth alongside this overarching narrative that we kind of can create in our minds oftentimes, where it's just like, oh, and I, nothing worked until I found the one true thing that cured them all. You know what I mean? And it's, I say this with irony because I've been encouraged often, or I've fallen into the trap of telling my story like that sometimes too. When the truth is that some things work and some things don't. And then I take that experience and I combine it with more stuff. And what you're going to get at the end of this is a person that is far more in charge of their own health and fitness and movement and body for the rest of their life, as opposed to someone who falls into some financial trouble and can't make their weekly PT session, and then therefore falls into a downward spiral where their health starts to go as well, because they don't have the, I guess, boots on the ground kind of experience in their own programming to understand how to continue for the rest of their life. So I think this is something I'm really passionate about. This is something I think is really important for people to be allowed to experiment and to be allowed to be a part of the process and to have agency in their own body, because that's the best bit. And that's what's going to be able to make that person do that for a lot longer.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, there are two unfortunate truths that we have to deal with. Number one being that our work relies on getting work, and as such, we are tempted to create reliancy to make sure that clients rely on us and our expertise. That's one unfortunate truth. The other unfortunate truth is that the amount of knowledge that any one individual can possess is finite. Even the most expert of experts has a finite amount of knowledge. The reason why it's good to collaborate with your clients is because even though the amount of knowledge that we can possess is finite, the number of interactions that can lead to new ideas is infinite. The interaction is, and the communication part is as important, if not more, than the knowledge of the trainer. And hopefully the knowledge of the trainer should let them understand that, that it is limited, and that you need information and you need collaboration from not only other trainers, but also other clients in order to come up with ideas that are better suited for a person at a specific point in time.
Yeah, 100%. I'm really glad we kind of went through this. And I'd love to kind of get a little bit more into the weeds about the different ways in which you program as well, and the different kind of concepts that you introduce in your programs and your workshops and stuff like this. And one of the concepts I've heard you come back to multiple times is the idea of kind of less specific training. And this is another thing that originally made parts of me crazy, because I was like, what do you mean? Where's the specific? But there's this bit about task-oriented training and about doing things to accomplish tasks that I'd never heard of until I kind of came across your work. So I'd love for you to talk into what is task-oriented training and why would you use that as an approach, and what are some of the benefits, and maybe what are some of the drawbacks of, compared to other approaches?
So it's primarily a mindset and perspective. It's a point of view. So let's take an exercise like a squat in which you have to stand with your feet shoulder width apart, turned slightly out. You push your knees out as you go into knee flexion and hip flexion, as you do an anterior pelvic tilt, and you maintain a somewhat neutral spine. And then you reverse the motion. Now compare that to looking at the squat as a task, which would be, I want you to keep both feet on the floor, and I want you to get your hips as low to the floor as possible. Or I want you to be able to pick up this malnourished cat while keeping a water bottle on your head. Or I want you to dodge this, I don't know, lacrosse ball that I'm throwing at you. Or I want you to sit. So when we're doing an exercise, we perform a specific type of technique in order to achieve a specific result. We're bending our ankles, our knees, our hips in a way that encourages certain muscles to be stressed in a particular way. And that stress should hopefully lead to an adaptation, which it will. A task, on the other hand, does not rely on a specific technique in order to achieve a result that comes later. Rather, we're moving in a way to achieve a result then and there. So if I say to you, stand on both feet and get your hips as low to the ground, that will lead to more outcomes than if I were to say, do an air squat or do a front squat or do a back squat. Now, there are two things that are happening. Number one, because you're focusing on creating the result then and there in the moment, it puts you in a different headspace. You become more aware of what you're doing then and there, and not too focused on the result that may come later. And also, you simply end up moving in many, many more, or a whole lot more ways, I should say. And what I appreciate about it the most, well, there are two things. Number one, it's fun. People enjoy it. I enjoy it. It's playful. It's creative. You're focusing on solving a problem and not so much just replicating an answer that somebody else has given to you. Mm. And so it puts you into that DIY mindset that we talked about. It allows you to be creative. It allows you to be a problem solver and not an encyclopedia of technique knowledge. Number two, it makes the people who do it feel more confident about their movement and about their bodies, because they're establishing a realistic relationship with their bodies, which is not the expectation that, oh, if I only improve my mobility or my strength in that particular muscle, all my problems will be solved. And truly, movement godhood is not too far away. Instead, you go like, oh shit, I have a hard time lying down on the floor when I keep both of my hands behind my head. Mm. Or, holy crap, I have a hard time being able to place an object on the floor towards 11 o'clock if I'm standing on one leg. Mm. Or, oh, I find it actually very difficult to squat while making sure that my spine is as rounded as possible because I'm trying to stay as low to the floor as possible. It creates confidence based on realism and not based on idealism. Mm. You become confronted with limitations, and you also get to see what your body is doing here and now in relation to its ability to solve problems.
Yeah, 100%. So is this, I've got a couple of questions on this task-oriented training thing. Is this, first of all, is this how you train? Or maybe a better question is, how much is this how you train?
Mm-hmm.
And are there specific contexts in which you would default to a more task-oriented approach as opposed to a more conventional exercise-based approach? And if so, for which outcomes would you say that one is maybe advantageous over another?
Mm. I personally train this as often as I can. Mm. It's usually a little bit every day. It's not the majority of my training, but it takes up the biggest space in my head when I'm moving in general, which is just like, I'm going to give myself an assignment. I'm going to give myself a puzzle. I'm going to give myself a quiz. Now let's see what I'm able to do. And tasks like these, they can be very immediate or they can be slightly bigger. Like sometimes the task can be, can I make myself feel better with movement? Can I make my neck feel better with movement? And how would I go about doing that? And then instead of looking for answers online, then I entertain ideas offline.
Mm.
And there tends to be a lot of them. Now, as for the training part, people do be different, right? Some people like structure more. And so you should allow them to have that structure. Mm. Now, the people that I find benefit from this the most are, number one, people who are not attracted to the idea of conventional training. They don't like the structure. They don't like the counting. They don't like the weights. They don't like the gym. They don't like those particular intensive exercises or repetitive exercises. Let's give them something else. Mm. But also, there are people who are so focused on resources and accruing more that they don't think about resource management. So how do you use your strength and how do you use your mobility? Examples of these kind of people are the ones that train mobility all the time, yet still feel stiff and not fluid and not flowy and not like they're not able to kind of express their mobility, as they say in the biz. For them, give them tasks. People end up having very unrealistic expectations, you know, when it comes to what they should get from their strength and their mobility. They focus a little less on the movement aspect of things, the immediate aspect of things, and the mindful aspect of movement. And then giving them those kind of tasks can be very helpful. I also do it for a lot of athletes. We create then environments and assignments that are more specific to the type of sport they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I've used a lot of task-oriented training for climbers because climbing is basically a task. But we create a more specific environment that allows them to work on a specific part of their activity.
Yeah, this is really cool. And so just to tie the bow off on this task-oriented training thing, if someone's mm-hmm. listening at home and they say, cool, this sounds cool, but I don't have the depth of experience that John Yuen has, so how do I start task-oriented training? How would I start experimenting with this by myself when I don't maybe have all of like the kind of library of task-oriented things to go and do? Are there ways that you would encourage people to go and inquire about this? Is it just like everything is okay? Or are there more effective ways to do this for someone starting out than for another?
I mean, most of all, it's an idea, you know, it's not a training method. At least not that one that I know of. And I would hesitate to make it into an official trademark training method, because
mm-hmm.
That would suck a lot of the joy and the creativeness out of it.
Yeah.
But we all need to start somewhere. And although I believe that perfection is not a thing that actually exists, it can be a good place to start. You know, we start with perfection because there is less leeway there, and we get to try something out, something specific that prevents us from floundering around in the dark, hoping that we're actually embodying this idea. But an easy way of doing it is I have a free online course on task-oriented training. There are like 9 different tasks you can try out. Head to my website and you'll find it there, and enjoy. Play around with it. See what happens.
Nice. I'll make sure I link that in the episode description as well, so you can click on that and head over and check that out as well. That's awesome. And yeah, you have a ton of really cool free resources as well as some awesome paid ones. So I'll link all that stuff in the description. But this is starting to flow into another something you touched on before, which is the task-oriented training is not necessarily the majority of your training. And in fact, something else might be. So when it comes to like play and, you know, fun stuff versus the more structured, maybe strength and mobility side of things, like what is that majority of your training and what does that look like in terms of like that kind of nuts and bolts kind of thing?
What is the majority? It's a good question. I haven't thought about it. what's important for me in my training is that the different parts of the training feeds into the other parts of the training, and that anything that I do encourages that I get to do something else. I try not to get locked down in one particular method. So for example, with my structured training, I train at the gym every day, but I only do 2 exercises. I try to keep it minimal. And then I have like in the very beginning of the morning, I do a little mobility, mobilization type of routine. And then I usually have some sort of activity that I want to pursue or try out, some other time during the day. Just so I get freedom to try out new things, and I still have a solid base that allows me to get in touch with my body, kind of notice and experience what's going on. That's what I do in the morning. And the strength training, which I think is just generally a very good idea. It helps getting a bit stronger or to maintain that strength, making sure that you have a bit of muscle mass to aid those joints. The most important part for me, I would say the majority of my training is to focus on not doing so much of one thing that I'm discouraged from doing other things. You know, a lot of us have this Frankenstein-esque relationship to movement. The movement is a monster, and every day it needs to be revived by Dr. Frankenstein with a whole lot of lightning and a whole lot of energy. And all the villagers get very upset. You know, I try to keep movement alive. I try not to make it so challenging or so intensive or so time consuming or so life consuming that it's something I get to keep alive throughout the day. You know, I can move about. I can do a bit of light stretching in the park. I can take a break from my work and I can practice some skill that I want to practice. I can make sure that it's not something that it doesn't become a beast that consumes itself, you know? That's a bit of a sidetrack. But yeah, in general, like I would say the basis of my training is gentle mobilization in the morning and strength training sometime in the afternoon, and then some other activity. And that activity, it can be climbing, but it could also be like painting or pottery, just something that keeps my brain fresh.
Yeah, nice. Now, this is funny because it's, you know, it calls to mind a slightly contrasted approach from another advocate of movement who will remain nameless, in the sense that some other approaches have a very high volume approach and very, you know, total life-consuming approach to movement and to skill acquisition and all these things, into doing 3 sessions a day, you know, for, you know, 6-7 days a week and that kind of approach. So I guess my first question would be, the way that you train now with this kind of more minimalistic approach, is that how you always train? Is that how you develop the impressive physical capacities that you have in terms of your splits and your handstand and that kind of thing? Well, that's my first question. I'll stop throwing 10 questions at you at the same time. Let's go with that.
No, it changes. It changes. You know, there's going to be time where the structured or the training program takes up more space. And then there's going to be times where it takes up less space. I have not achieved, and I don't think I ever will achieve, balance in one particular point in time. Balance is, you know, is spread across a great number of days, weeks, and months, and years. Mm-hmm. So yeah, for now, this is how I train. But I have trained a lot more like structured in the past when I wanted to experience that. Now I've found that it doesn't really serve me. But it might in the future. I can't predict who I'm going to be tomorrow. So who knows? But for now, this is how the training is. And for now, I find it very enjoyable.
Yeah, I love that. And this is the other side of the coin. This is why your work interests me so much, because there are parts of me that do, to a fault, go down the structured road. To the point where I think that in the past I've certainly confused myself as far as how structured I thought I was being and how much optimization in air quotes I thought I was doing. And yeah, there were parts of me that had resistance to that more improvised or more auto-regulated approach, because there was a part of me that felt that wasn't disciplined and you know, focused enough, when really a lot of my training and a lot of the problems that I was having in my training was around not enough of that approach. It was around it was around training too much and burning myself out. It was around developing overuse injuries from trying to do the same thing so much, and trying to chase that, you know, high performance approach to the point where I just keep on making a lot of progress and falling in a heap and making a lot of progress and then falling in a heap. So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about maybe the other side of the coin, maybe the, you know, if you were to do a higher volume approach, that, you know, 3 times a day, do you think that that does work? How do you think that works? Do you think that's a more similar to the martial arts thing where it breaks people more than it makes? What do you think about that kind of school of thought when it comes to movement and skill training?
That's a great question. Well, the first thing I would like to say is that, you know, we don't want to end up creating a false dichotomy where structure is void of autoregulation, or that experimentation, exploration, and creativity is the absence of structure. You know, it's our lives, it's our minds. We can decide what these things are, you know, and that's often where the fun of programming comes in. Because you get to think about these concepts and what they actually mean to you and how you want to approach them. You certainly do not have to do very emotionally laden spinal waves in order to be explorative or creative, right? That being said, when it comes to answer your question, when it comes to high volume training, people respond so differently to higher volumes. There are people who will progress and need a greater volume due to their tolerance to stress. And in that case, having more sessions per day can be very helpful. Another benefit of having more sessions per day is that you don't need to do too much volume on any one individual session, which then facilitates recovery, but it also facilitates performance. You know, it allows you to balance out work and recovery in more ways. You have more opportunities to balance that out. But if somebody says to you that you need to work out 3 times a day in order to get the volume that you need, they're probably too focused on a very particular part of the population. There are people who will progress more by doing 6 sets of an exercise per week than if they were to do 20. Mm-hmm. You know, we are very different when it comes to how we respond to volume. So like for me, there are certain body parts that respond better to higher volumes. I tend to need to do more pressing than pulling in order to progress to the same degree.
Much quite similar.
And you'll find that some people have more resilient hammies than they do quads, and some people have more resilient shoulders than, or anterior shoulders than they do posterior shoulder. It's so different. And that's why it's so important in a program to let the program be a test of itself and not a test of you. You know, like you shouldn't create a program in order to test an individual's ability to be disciplined and structured enough to get through it. The program is first and foremost a test of itself, and it should not work perfectly on the first try. It should continue to evolve. And if that evolves into being 3 times per day with a huge volume, and you are indeed progressing, not just pushing yourselves further to prove that the program works and that you're able to work the program, then that's good. But nobody is smart enough, no one, to say with certainty that 3 times per day works for absolutely everyone. If they're saying that they need to be, I don't know, they need to walk into the forest and stay there for a couple of days without any food or shelter. Like really, like you need to become very familiar with your own limitations. And then you can reevaluate what you just said, you know?
I really just want to highlight that. Like the program should be a test of itself, not a test of you. That is just one, if there was just one takeaway from this chat, it would be that for me, because not only because I need to remind myself of that, but also because it's so huge and I don't hear enough people talking about this. The fact that there isn't this magical program out there that's going to be great. But also I've been in this situation before where I've received a program from a coach after, you know, in that case, minimal assessment, unfortunately, but I received this program and it became this daunting task because at that time I felt that this guy had answers that I wanted. And then when I got this program and I found myself suffering through it, and by kind of, this happened actually twice to me, even not too long ago, I was just kind of suffering through this. And I was like, oh man, this is such a death march. This is such a slog. And I found my results just start to go down, 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 down. I was like, oh, I must not be good enough for this program. And
yeah,
I can now see with hindsight outside of that, that it's everyone, people do be different, to quote John Yuan. it is really different. It's really important to have some form of measurement and feedback system built in, even if it's just how do I feel, to understand, is this program working for me? And if the answer is no, it's like, that's okay. This is a conversation I have with my clients all the time. I'm like, oh, something's not really working, or I feel like this. And I'm like, dude, that's fine. Like, thanks for telling me, because now we can do something about that. Now we can tweak it. And there's, now we can start to get that person back on track to something that's working for them. And it's just so massive.
Yeah, no, I think trainers should be more vocal about this, I think.
Yeah.
The best way of demonstrating that you have an understanding of a subject is to show the many ways in which that knowledge can be applied. And that goes for programs as well. You know, I have programs that are twice a day, and I haven't gone to three times a day yet, but also programs that are like once a week, you know, and that's because I'm training different people. And sometimes, you know, we start off with something that's a bit closer to the average. That's how I like to apply the knowledge I have of just how people respond to training, is to start off with something closer to the average, and then it changes. It should grow, and it can grow in many different directions. But it's all dependent on our ability to communicate, our ability to exchange ideas and also information.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
And if you have a coach and you're listening to this, then this is a conversation that, you know, you can definitely have, or hopefully you can have with that person. But if you don't, this is also a conversation that you can have with yourself. It's mm-hmm. one where you can sit down and you can look at intermittently. It might be every 4 weeks. It might be every day. It might be, you know, and you can say, well, how is this? How am I feeling with this approach? How is this working out for me? Am I enjoying the things that I'm doing? Am I progressing further towards the things that I would like to be able to do? Is this working for me? You know, like, these are all conversations and questions that you can start to ask yourself to start to dial in this own program. And if the answer is no to any of those things, then you can run little experiments and try different things and say, what if I was to add a little bit more task-oriented training in? So maybe if I'm not enjoying it, maybe I can spice things up a little bit. Or if maybe I'm not making that progress, then maybe I'm feeling burned out, I can try to do less. Or if I'm not making progress and I feel like I've got more to give, I can try to do more. And even just running these really little basic experiments with yourself can start to drive you closer to home to the approach that's going to work for you, rather than doing what I did for many years, which is bounce around putting people on pedestals and thinking that they had the one magical approach. And I can tell you that doing it with yourself is way more fun. It's going to last you longer, and it's also going to, it's more empowering. And that person, if they're a good coach, would just have to do that with you anyway. So it's a really, really powerful mindset shift to start to make, and a liberating one as well.
Yeah. Very good points. Yeah, no, I it's interesting, you know, people who take control of their own programming who are allowed to have creative input in their own programming, for some weird reason, they tend to stick to what they're doing for a longer time.
Yeah.
Because the thing they're doing changes, because they're allowing themselves not to be dependent on the answer.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I'm really glad that we went there. That was really cool. the last thing, as we kind of bring this towards a close, I remember in our last call together, you talked about your research process and how you've studied under some amazing coaches, and you had some amazing teachers like the ballet teacher that you mentioned and your martial arts masters. But you've also spent a lot of time on your own exploring, and, you know, you just said with a kind of pen and a notebook and exploring different things for yourself. And I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about what led you to start to do that. You're the only person so far that I've met that's done this kind of thing. And I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about what that process is like, how you came about it, and what it looks like, and how people might be able to start to do that for themselves if it interests them at all.
I don't really have like a method or a system for things. I only have like a core belief, I guess, and that is that everything deserves to be creative. We've touched upon this many times during the conversation, but yeah, I like making things, and I like to see how the world responds to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that world might be the external world, or it might be the one that is inside of me. That was very deep. But yeah, if you want to see something in the world, then go ahead and make it, you know. Yes, we live in a very capitalist world where a lot of people create a lot of interesting and unique solutions, but that doesn't mean that all of our needs have been fulfilled. It doesn't mean that that something out there will allow you to experience something unique to you. So you kind of need to give yourself the opportunity to come up with stuff. Because it's not just about the things that you make. It's also about the process of standing in an empty room and then trying to come up with something. Like, okay, I want to create a new task. I want to create a new task for this workshop that I did this weekend. I had to stand in an empty room and just kind of think for a bit and then try out different things and think about like giving myself different prompts. I often just write down a list of words that I use to kind of spark inspiration. And then instead of like trying to come up with something very detailed, I just look at the word and I try to figure out how I can make something useful out of that word in this particular context of task-oriented training. And sometimes I just write down how I feel and how I think I could improve how I feel. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just about accepting it. Sometimes I go off and do something entirely else where I make something, you know, whether it's like that's trying to knit a sweater or paint a flower or I don't know, do pottery. It's all about like not, I don't ever want to end up in the situation where I believe that I'm completely dependent on what other people create in order for that to satisfy any potential need. I want to be able to be a part of that process myself. So I place myself in that mindset where I can go, I can come up with things and I can put them out into the world to see how the world responds to it and share it.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
So it's not very definitive, but it's mostly just about like, come up with stuff, do it yourself. Tear apart training methods and exercises and programs and articles and put them back together again. I think one of the reasons why I want to do it is so that I don't end up putting people on pedestals. And I appreciate them for what they're actually doing and for their actual knowledge or skill. You know, it's a whole lot of fun having a smartphone in general. But if you just kind of understand the basics of the engineering that's behind there, then you kind of lose respect for it and you gain respect for it in a different way. And it's closer to a reality. Same thing with other things like training.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And there's no, I love that there's no definitive system. It's like, well, this is, you can follow this set of three simple steps and you'll, you know, move like John Yuan. It's like that process of inquiry. And even if it just is in the beginning, confronting what parts of yourself come up when you do stand in that empty room and you are just like, oh, well, I have no structure now. And now I need to rely on my own internal sense of what would I like to do? Or how do I feel? And what would happen if I didn't know what I was doing? And even that process in itself is something that I'm definitely going to go and explore a little bit more myself, because when you were talking before about people feeling constrained to exercises, this is something I've definitely started as I've started to explore more soft acrobatics and this kind of thing, as I've started to come across learning different moves, but still being very much a rookie and trying to put things together and trying to explore and trying to be flowy. It's not something that necessarily just comes as a sum of lots of different parts. There's more, there are more things, there are more capacities that I'm yet to explore and yet to build. So if not, this has really been a really eye-opening conversation for me as well, because to hear you with someone as competent and in moving and as skilled and as strength as you are to talk about things in this less structured, more explorative way, it's definitely given me confidence. And I hope to the people listening at home as well, that there's not this one magical way that you can start to explore and find a way of moving that is both enjoyable to you and also effective as well, and come out with something that's uniquely yours at the other end.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, power to the people, man. I know that I'm gradually sounding more and more like a 70s hippie, but like, you know, I honestly believe that that it's way more interesting to come up with your own answers instead of just looking for everybody else's, because it's not about the answer, it's the process towards how you're getting there, you know, and that process, it involves a lot of self-doubt, and it involves frustration at times, but it also gives you a particular type of confidence, where you can say, oh, there's nothing magical behind that system or that method that somebody else is promoting. It's just an idea that somebody else really, really wants to share and perhaps profit from. And I like certain aspects of it. So I'm going to borrow those, and then I'm going to come up with the rest. You know, it's a matter of kind of just believing in yourself and your own ability to make stuff and try them out. And once you understand the process of making things, you also understand the process of testing them. And that allows you also to have less expectations about what a program or what an exercise will give you. And instead, you become more focused on what's actually going on as you're doing it. And it becomes its own kind of mindfulness, where you're not mindful for the sole purpose of getting a result, but you're mindful for the sake of being mindful, for the sake of paying attention, and for the sake of understanding both the immediate possibilities, but also the immediate limitations. And that is where, you know, it feeds back into the creativity aspect of it again.
Man, I love that answer. And I think this is a perfect place to kind of leave things off. And I have really, really enjoyed this. And
likewise, man.
Yeah, man. If people have enjoyed listening to you talk about this kind of more creative approach to movement and to programming, and they want to find out more, yeah, where can they go to where are you most active? Where should they go to follow more of your stuff?
Well, you can go to unjohn.com. And where I'm most active is probably my newsletter, which I send out twice per month. But feel free to check out that if you want to. More importantly, like, get in touch with me if you want to talk. And like we've talked about in this conversation, don't feel like you need to come with a certain level of expertise or experience in order to discuss topics. You know, like, there's something that you mentioned in the podcast that I felt didn't make sense. I work as a carpenter. I'm not a trainer. That's perfectly fine. You know, like I mentioned, like the exchange of ideas is where the beauty lies. So feel free to exchange ideas and to challenge ideas with me. Get in touch.
Awesome. I love the open invitation. Yeah, man, this has been so awesome. And thanks so much for your time. And thanks for doing this, man.
My pleasure. My pleasure. I hope I made some sense.
I think you will, brother.
It's like with podcast interviews, the format of so many things these days and kind of encourages me to come up with definitive answers. And to have like a definitive system or method, but I really don't. And so I can understand if it's if it might feel difficult to grasp or understand some of these concepts. And that's because I don't really grasp or understand them myself. I'm just doing things, making things up and see where it takes me and having a lot of fun while doing so. But yeah, that's why it's important for me to kind of invite people to continue the conversation. This is just the beginning.
Dude, 100%. And I'm really, really glad that you went the direction that you did, because this is another thing that I have read you say before, that like there's no shortage of people giving very nitty-gritty detailed specific answers. There's no shortage of that whatsoever. There's a million different people saying that this is the one way and this is the specific number of sets and reps that we should be doing or whatever. There's no shortage of that. But I think what there is a much greater shortage of is people that are willing to explore open-ended threads and willing to look the complexity and the chaos of things in the eye and say, well, there is a lot of things at play here. How might I kind of come to this? With what flavor of mindset might I come to this set of problems so that I can enjoy these things and maybe get some of the benefit out of it as well, but not cheat myself into thinking that I'm doing something that I'm not, or any of these things. So I'm really glad that, you know, that the questions went the way they did, because and these podcasts is not for me to be marketable or anything like that. It's for me to really interview people and see what you do think. So if you feel that you were true to that, then that means I'm a happy boy. So.
Sure thing. And yeah, for all you listeners out there, we're going to continue with our Patreon call, where we're actually going to talk about what we really think about training.
Yeah, it's for the low, low price of $9.99 a month. And you can get access to all the exclusive details of how John Nguyen really trains. Three secret tips he didn't tell you in this podcast. Sign up now.
Let's talk about the application of L-Kmeek and the actual true ginseng root and what it can do to your side.
100%.
Go.
All right, boom. That is a wrap. I really hope you enjoyed that one, guys. I've really got so much out of that episode. And if you want to hear John talk more about movement in general, if you want to check out some of his exercise programs that he's got online, you can see all of that over at yuenjohn.com. That's yuenjohn.com. And you can check out all of his offerings there as well. Sign up for that newsletter that he mentioned. And as always, guys, if you're feeling a bit stagnant with your regular gym workouts and you want to start exploring how you could train for some bodyweight strength skills to not only tick the strength and aesthetics and mobility boxes that you'd like your body to be able to move and look in certain ways, but also fall back in love with training and just have a way better time, you can check out whitebelt.com. It's whitebelt.com/train. And you can check out what skill-based strength training is and how it might be able to help you do those things. And if you have any questions, guys, you can always reach out and get in touch with myself on Instagram. I'm at Fernandez_whitebelt. Again, WHYTBELT. And guys, hope you enjoyed the episode. I'll catch you in the next one.